When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 6 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $2.99 each. Then get flavorful large avocados for 99 cents each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the first episode of Tom Lucy Plus One. For those of you who don't know, my name is Tom Lucy. I'm a comedian. I'm 21 years old, and this is my new podcast where I chat to different people from the world of entertainment every week. Before we start, I just want to say a big thank you to everyone who came to my shows at the Soho Theatre this week. It was amazing that so many people came, and it was so much fun. So thank you very much if you were one of those people. I also have a bit of a confession to make. You may have remembered that I said in the introduction that the first guest this week was the brilliant Tom Odell. We have recorded an episode with Tom, but due to some scheduling cock-up on my part, we are putting that episode out in a couple of weeks. But we have a brilliant replacement in the form of Russell Kane. Russell is an incredible comedian and so intelligent. And he very kindly invited me round to his house. And we talked for a couple of hours about loads of things. And he's got a lot to say from himself. So I think you're really going to enjoy it. So here it is. This is the first episode with the brilliant Russell Kane.
Yeah,
It's just the really, really good shit from coconut oil. That's all it is. Imagine right. the poshest coconut oil you can think of.
Yeah.
It's got all the coconut flavour taken out of it. It's more like a thin liquid. And the particular triglycerides in there are what's called a caprylic acid, C8, if you want to be technical.
Okay.
So those, tablespoon of that, tablespoon of that, whisk together as fast as you can, get a little hand whisk in a coffee.
It's the best. But I've seen you actually do that backstage.
Yeah, I've got a portable whisk.
Like a little portable whisk.
Looks like a dildo or some sort of drug implement. And that's what I have, but it's called a bulletproof coffee. It's.
But then, I remember you saying to me that it takes, there's like a certain amount of time before it like kicks in. It's like 10 minutes or something.
Well, it's you know, I always have it 20 minutes before I go on stage. I'm quite Asperger's about that. That's why, for example, there's a gig we're considering doing tonight. I won't name it on here.
Yeah.
And I've heard that gig is a bit like, oh, you're going to be on in 5 minutes. Maybe it'll be 10. Oh, you can be on in 20.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
is my idea of hell. I've got like an Usain Bolt starter gun approach. I have to know.
What time you're on.
I love to know. Rush, you're on in 20. Rush, you're on in 15. 10, 5, 4, 3. And then someone lights a touch
paper.
Like
well,
that's how I...
breakfast TV presenter.
That's how I get... It's just the energy. It's the amount of energy. It's yeah. not as bad as it was. Because the nerves are better, but the amount of energy it takes to launch whatever I do on stage is like some sort of event in my brain.
Yeah.
And the coffee and the fat, which I do believe is the best source of energy for human beings, fat.
From the butter.
For any sort of good fat, but this particular drink is a handy way of delivering it.
Yeah.
I eat sort of lard, dripping, avocado, coke, and then I protein second, and then of course evil carbs. I don't really eat many unless I've done a lot of exercise. So yeah, that plus timing is like the launch. If you watch the start of my act, is the only bit I'm ever concerned about.
Yeah.
If a light breaks or a joke fails 15 minutes in, I don't care. I can't think of a gig I've lost
yeah.
15 minutes in.
Yeah.
I just can't think. It's just never happened because I'm not really material based. So
yeah.
I can't really accidentally go, oh, Madeleine McCann, and the audience goes, what have you said? I'm sort of yeah. personality and energy based.
Once you get started, you're
once I go past that first 5 minutes and they're like, oh my God, I always thought he was a cunt, he's actually all right.
Yeah.
Once I've got past that, which happens more and more the more TV you do,
yeah,
I feel like I can do anything. Like anything could go wrong. Like someone could pass out, there can be a fire drill and we can leave the building and come back. But that takeoff from the runway is the most risky bit of stand-up. It's the same as flight, in fact. The only most dangerous part of your flight, once you're airborne after about 2 minutes, statistically you're safe.
It's just taken off.
Takeoff is absolutely lethal for
stand-ups. So what happens, because I don't think I've ever spent much time with you after gigs. Is the come down afterwards quite severe?
No, I tend to be, like, I really want to talk about the gig afterwards for about half an hour. I'll phone Lindsay, even though we've been married for 4 years and together for 6 years. And this happened, and there was a guy in the front row that said this. I mean, I'm still, like, I still have that that level
of... Is that why it's hard to then go and do another gig? Because you're just buzzing about the
It's
one.
Just never as good. It's just... Trying to think of a less crude analogy than wanking or fucking, but I'm sure it's very nice to fuck twice in a night, and many men have done it. But no one on earth is going to tell me the second session is as good as that first tingling electricity. And like I say, I'm not material based, so when you see me on stage, I'm very, very rarely faking the surprise or emotions.
Yeah.
So to do that twice in a night. Just the second one's just plastic. It doesn't mean you can't have a good plastic gig. You can have a good mechanical plastic gig to the point where the audience wouldn't even know.
Yeah.
But you can't have that magical gig a second time. Not unless you hold something back on the first one.
I remember that story you told me about when you did McIntyre's TV show and they kept pushing your time back.
That happened to me then. So I was supposed to be at the end of the first, in the middle of the first half, and then it was the end of the first half.
So this is Michael McIntyre's big show.
It's the biggest comedy gig you can do on TV at the moment for a stand-up. I think about seven, eight million.
Yeah.
Maybe more. I don't know what watches. But all I know is you can't really get on TV before 9 p.m. to 8 million people. It just doesn't happen. Your only other option is to go online and do your own stuff.
Yeah.
So I had to absolutely ace it. And, of course, you get a stage time, say, 8:30 p.m. But I know from my experience with TV...
Yeah.
I was being annoying. I kept checking. And when I heard the 10-minute delay, I was drinking my coffee more slowly, pacing myself a little bit. talking to people at the side of the stage to keep the banter engines going rather than sitting in a corner.
Yeah.
And then they just said, you're postponed to the second half. So what I did was I just reset all engines, made another coffee.
Reset all engines?
Yeah, because there was no point in me trying to jog on the spot and carry on because you'd go on too frantic.
Yeah.
You'd go on.
It is amazing.
You can be aggressive. You wouldn't finish your sentences properly. You might muddle your thoughts. So I just went back up. Had a glass of water, made another coffee and thought, right, my gig's in an hour, pretend none of that happened. And then I went on and it was just one of the best gigs of my career.
Yeah, you smashed it. I remember seeing it.
I loved it.
Yeah. I've not worked with any other comic who has that sort of like pre-show.
It's the speed. Maybe if you spoke to Lee Evans or Phil Nichol or someone like that, I don't know. But it's not what I'm doing is any better than anyone else. It's just a lot more energy and tends to be a lot quicker. So if you think about what we do is so complicated and difficult and scary and there's so many decisions to make. When you put your foot on the stage and there's all these different audience members and you've seen someone, oh my God, and there's someone there who might be from a part of society you were about to talk about, even though you're on their side. Is it going to throw the room? Oh shit, do I drop my Windrush routine about Jamaican immigrants? Do I do it? All of that's going through your head.
Yeah.
Or the compares just fucking use the word that's in my first joke. Oh, fuck. Oh, yeah. Someone's seen me before, mouthing. It's all going through your head. Now imagine that at 10 times the speed. Mm. I don't have the ability to go, hello, is everyone all right? Find myself on stage, give myself a second, sort my head out. I'm like, good evening, like that.
Yeah.
And
it is amazing, like, when you go to watch. Like, I remember being sort of 16, first time I went up to Edinburgh Festival.
Yeah.
And my dad came up and I took him to watch your show.
Did you?
The Assembly Rooms.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the big one.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite a massive venue. And
was it at the McEwen Hall? Wasn't there, was it?
No, it was up on. I don't remember what it's called. The Assembly Rooms, the big
one. Shit, was that the one where I had to cancel a couple of shows because the sound was so bad?
I think so. Yeah.
Did you come later in the run when it was a bit better?
Yeah, it was great. Well, I just remember because it was like obviously an hour, but it was like the fastest. It was just like the. Well, I've never seen my dad laugh as much.
No,
it was so like sort of fast.
I'm not going. I'm sure there are some comics that are like, hey, I'm going to be a high energy persona, but I'm not doing it. For effect, that's what my normal.
Yeah.
This is me chilled out in a lounge.
I know, yeah.
So it's that plus adrenaline. I've never got on top of the adrenaline. I've never controlled it. The nerves have never settled. It's just, they're obviously never going to for me. So I've had to work with them.
Yeah.
So it's my actual natural fucking.
So what was it like when you started doing open mics? Were you that high octane?
It was horrific.
Even at the beginning.
It was so bad. It was horrible. So I was working in an office in an ad agency.
Yeah.
And we'd all go for a night out. And the same thing started to happen in that office as happened with my friends when I was growing up. By the time we were up next morning, all having a coffee or a cup of tea, and I'm telling what's happened in the office, everyone's crying, laughing, even though everyone was there. All I'm doing is describing what happened. I'm not adding any words in.
Yeah.
I had no idea that that was a talent. That was just my personality. I've done it since I was a kid.
Yeah.
But because I was finally mixing with middle class people that knew about things like theatre and stand-up, which I'd never really heard of. I went to a university that had no stand-up club. And by the time I went to uni, I was so like working class snob. I was only interested in dead authors, philosophy, really intellectual shit. I absolutely was adamant I was going to get a first class honours degree and that I would get the highest degree in my year above all the private school kids, which I did. So of course I missed all of the drama and theatrical society at my uni as well. I was just like in books all week and then party hard at the weekend.
Yeah.
By like techno and Penguin Classics. They're my things. So I'd got all the way to graduation, Council Estate, A-levels there, without ever having any contact with stand-up comedy in my entire life.
Yeah.
Zero.
Yeah.
I'd never been to see it. I knew nothing about it. My only thing I knew was that my dad liked Jim Davison and Jimmy Jones and that Eddie Murphy was once a stand-up but was now an actor. I'd never watched any of it. It was the distant thing. Like if we talked about lacrosse now, you're probably like, I'm sort of aware it exists.
Yeah.
But it's over there.
Right, yeah.
I didn't know. I just didn't connect it with my personality. It just wasn't there. But in the office, it started to happen after a few weeks and months. And obviously, there's so many creative people when you're in advertising this guy said to me, "You are a natural stand-up. Have you ever been to watch it? You should do it." And I was like, it never occurred to me.
Yeah.
So I started to write down, over a period of about a month, every time I told a story to my pub in the, to my mates in the pub and they laughed, I would write it down. If it was one that was one I'd told before, like my nan walked in on me banking once when I was 18, and if I'm on a drink out with a new group of friends, I would always tell that story because it's just so unbelievable. So I wrote it down. I got five of those.
I remember that story from the show.
Yeah, it's just horrible. And then I honestly sat down at a desk, Googled stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
It was this disinterested. Clicked the first link, which was Comedy Cafe London. Any club could have come up, Comedy London. Phoned the first number, said, can I try stand-up?
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, I've got 2 weeks. You come down on a Wednesday unpaid. In those 2 weeks, I went to watch stand-up for the first time. Yeah. Just to see what all the fuss was about.
Yeah.
I went to a Jonglers, don't remember who I saw, went to the Comedy Store, only remember one act, funnily enough, who turned out to be the open spot, Susan Murray. I just remember really laughing at her.
Yeah.
Don't remember any of the other acts. I think the comp here might have been Justin Morehouse. And I went to a couple of Laughing Horse gigs.
Yeah.
I think Liam Malone might have been on, don't know. And that's all. That's
and
all
then right. Your first gig was the Comedy Cafe.
So what I was watching was... where they came on from, Haggy took the mic out the stand. I wasn't watching the stand-up. I was watching, oh, you're standing there. Oh, right, okay. I was like, because I just knew nothing.
I can't imagine, like, I think, I sort of, with loads of comics, I can imagine when they started them being quite shit, but you, I imagine in my head that you started and were the same as you are now.
It worked both in my favour and against me, my lack of knowledge. Yeah. Most stand-up, I started just as Live at the Apollo was commissioned for TV.
Yeah.
I think it was commissioned about 2004, 2005.
Yeah.
Thank God I hadn't seen it.
Yeah.
Because what my complete staggering ignorance of a joke and a punchline was taken for this breathtaking originality.
Yeah.
Which I've stuck to. I will do whole stories where people laugh and I go, yeah, anyway, and that's what happened at the end. Yeah. I don't bother with punchlines. If there's not one there, it doesn't bother me.
Yeah.
As long as the story's properly funny.
Yeah.
Because I'm like hanging out with you, genuinely telling you a story. Like in real life, I wouldn't try and get to the end of this story now and there's a big at the end. So I treat my audience the same because I'm not really doing jokes and stuff.
I suppose that in normal conversation, not every stories don't have that massive
but yet,
reveals you, at the end.
But yet you would still laugh your ass off with your mate telling each other the story, and then there'd just be a comfortable pause and you talk about something else.
Yeah.
So I didn't know that wasn't a possibility.
Yeah.
So I just went with my five stories about my nan and just told it at the comedy cafe. It was all right. Got a couple of laughs, but most people probably don't on their first gig.
Yeah.
But what went against me was, although I was the like monkey boy they wheeled out at the ad agency, so if we're pitching to a client, I always stood up and did the funny thing at the end.
Yeah.
I would get incredibly nervous even that. I used to do all the school plays at school, but I lost my nerve when I was about 13 and I just, public speaking, I just throw up, diarrhea, the worst nerves you can imagine.
I mean,
just the worst. To the point where I think I was on the toilet constantly before that first gig, and I went to walk out as well. And Pete Jonas was like, "Just do it, mate. Think about it like a."
Thought you were gonna leave.
I just thought, what am I doing? I've got a fucking brilliant. I'm a chaff from a council estate. I've got a brilliant career.
Yeah.
I hate public speaking.
Yeah.
If I want a hobby, do French or maybe do an MA in the evening, which was something I wanted to do in my masters.
Yeah.
What is this about? Am I going to need my ego dick sucked? I was just doing it because a friend at work told me to try it.
Yeah.
And then Pete Jonas grabbed my arm and he went, "You'll regret it if you don't try it."
Yeah.
So I went up, hand was like that with the microphone. It was all right. But that the two laughs I got were enough to make me think, I'll do the one I've got booked in tomorrow. I booked two nights just to see if I would like it, the Wednesday and the Thursday.
Yeah.
So I went to the King's Head the next night. And you sort of queue up in a line at the side of the King's Head, and it got to me, and I was like, no, I'm definitely walking this time. And again, someone grabbed my arm and was like, just try it. And I went on, and that one I smashed.
Yeah.
That one I fucking smashed, the second one. Like, whew, I got off, and I was like, what the fuck was that?
Yeah.
That I just felt. I never felt anything like that in my life, not even in advertising. I'd never felt that proper rush of, let's face it, fucking just complete human ego.
Yeah.
The most at home I'd ever felt. And I was like, I need to book a few more of these in. And inevitably, because I knew
nothing. And then you just sort of got addicted to it like everyone does.
Yeah, but yeah. But because I knew nothing, I did have a couple of shockers.
Yeah.
But not as many as anyone else, I will admit that. But I didn't know that certain things were happening. No one sat down and go, right, don't talk about wanking because all new comedians do it. No one sat me down and told me that.
Yeah, yeah.
No one said you need punchlines at the end. There wasn't a book or a website.
You think that's quite weird about... I was talking about this with someone the other day about stand-up where there's no one tells you what to do. You have to work it all out yourself. No one at any point sits you down and goes...
No.
It's not like everything else in life, someone teaches you how to do it.
But most stand-ups have been like, yeah, I've been watching Russell Howard since I was 12. I've always loved stand-up. I've been to Edinburgh with my... Most people have got some connection.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah.
I had
nothing.
Zero, apart from my dad's Jimmy Jones DVDs that he would be on in the background. And I'll tell you another thing about blackfellas. So I just didn't know anything. So inevitably, when I got cocky, I think I was about 8 gigs in and got booked to do a 20-minute set. Something ridiculous like that.
Yeah.
A 20-minute set after 9 gigs at Up the Creek, Greenwich.
Which is a lot. Like, being booked for 20 minutes is like a big thing.
It's massive.
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe I was going to be paid. 180 quid, something obscene like that.
Yeah.
For me, just to talk shit into a microphone. And I turned up and it was different.
Mm.
That club at that time, how can I say? They didn't just seem drunk. They seemed quite chemically assisted. Very aggressive women, who's this new kid? And the way you're brought on there at that time was, it's a new kid, give him a chance.
Yeah.
And I just went on and I was just like, hey, I love wanking, or whatever I was saying, just like I would to my mates.
Yeah.
And this audience were like, you know, like some ultra working class audiences can be like, we don't like Phil, thank you. Just because we're poor.
Yeah.
There's a bit of that. And I got booed off. And I got...
That was your first 20 minutes?
Yeah, and I threw the money back at the promoter. I went, there's no way I'm taking that, keep it. And I ran out. I was crying by the time I was running down the street.
Oh, no.
And I realised, shit, you can't... I've been... Yes, okay, I'm blessed with energy and I can think up things really quickly and I know not many stand-ups have got that.
Yeah.
But you cannot fake experience.
Yeah.
Can't be faked. Getting used to being stood on stage where you've got that calm authority.
Yeah.
No one can jump that 3 years. It's just
from experience.
It's 3 years minimum.
Yeah.
For most, it's 5.
Yeah.
3 years where you can walk onto stage and where you've done it so many times, the adrenaline isn't at the point where it can damage the gig. Where mine was every night, it was just a matter of time
till something like that happened. Yeah.
It's like a heart attack waiting to happen.
Yeah.
Because the adrenaline was so high and the nerves were so bad. So I just had to keep going 3-4
times. Do you think, because I obviously wasn't around at that time when you started, but the impression I get is that you were very... What you were doing was so different to everyone else.
There's no punchlines or anything.
But do you feel like as much as that worked in your favour and you sort of had this reputation quite quickly, do you think that also drew the same amount of like hostility from other comics?
It didn't draw hostility from comics that I know of. I mean,
yeah.
God knows what's said about you in dressing rooms when you're not there.
Yeah.
I was quite... So in real life, I'm really like loyal and friendly and I'm always chatty. I'm backstage now, I'm like so interested in what everyone's doing.
Yeah.
But then because of the nerves, I would have to sit on my own. So I probably came across quite...
It's really weird that, isn't it? Because there's loads of people who are just nervous and shy before gigs, but they get a reputation for being difficult to work with. But it's not, they're just nervous.
In the end, I excluded myself from the drill. I learned quickly just to turn up at the last minute because your nerves can affect everyone else.
Yeah.
I don't think that would have pissed anyone off. No. I think more the telly industry, because I got recognition quite quickly.
Yeah.
So by 2006, I've been nominated for the Perrier. I've done my first telly job.
So that was 2 years after...
I did an open spot in 2003, but I did... There's a couple of open spots, but I didn't start doing it properly because of my job till 2006.
So 2 years.
I left in March. I was like, I need to start gigging regularly. I left my job in March, and in July, I was working on telly. And in August, I got nominated for the
Perrier. So that's what I mean. So that will draw from older comics.
Oh, jealousy, probably. Yeah, jealousy. Yeah. But so I won the Perrier, and then I think people are a little bit like, because of the energy and the difference, and they didn't know what to do with me on telly.
Yeah.
So the only thing to do with me was stand-up, because that was the thing I was smashing. So then I got all these big breaks really quickly.
Yeah.
And I went all on one channel, and I went... And it all happened a bit quickly, and I started... I'd got this wild haircut, and they put me in all these weird clothes, which I encouraged. I did encourage it. And I thought, oh yeah, like Noel Fielding and all that, like they're really cool. And of course, it's the worst thing I could have done, because then people were like, hang on a second, you were just like in your jeans and t-shirt. Why are you dressing like a cunt after 10 minutes?
What sort of stuff are they getting you to wear? Is this on BBC Three?
They weren't getting me to wear it. What it was, there was a show we did, and it was all like really cool, like a tumble down cellar. It was like a student-y thing.
Live at the Electric.
Yeah. There were a few things I pushed to change, like looking down the barrel of the camera.
Yeah.
But the feeling was, we want to make it different to Live at the Apollo. So if you don't want to look down the barrel of the camera and do this certain style, don't do the job.
Yeah.
It was getting near that.
Yeah.
So I was like, do you know what? Look down the barrel of the camera. And I fully bought into all the things they said in the end, even though initially I had reservations.
Yeah.
I then started getting caught up in the cool, like a goth impresario persona,
yeah,
and started really going for it with, I still wear the skinny jeans and stuff, but the hair was up here, and I just thought, it's brilliant, I've got like a costume.
I thought you had like a white stripe in your hair, I thought
it was really cool.
I remember that.
This only went on for about a year. I just wish someone had come to me and said, do you know what, don't change too quickly, because people might think, oh, you're not a real person after all if you can change that quickly. The reality is, I've just been on a council estate with my head down from aged 5 into my 20s. I never looked up, because people, where I come from, you don't look up, you just do it. So my first time I ever had freedom, so I was doing what most people do at 14, 15, having freedom, playing, doing what I want, partying. I'd never done it, so I quickly realised what I'd done, sort myself out, comb my hair. But by then I think there was a bit of
what do you think during that time that you got a bit carried away with all the other stuff,
I don't think I did, actually. I mean, I never was, had a problem with alcohol. Okay, I shagged about a bit when I was single, but I've always mostly had a girlfriend. But I think other people looking in thought, wait, you're lying about your age, you're acting younger than you are.
Yeah.
You've done something weird with your hair. We thought you were one of the good guys, you're just one of the cunts. But no one sat me down, and I wish a manager or someone had gone, Russ, what are you doing? Stick a suit on, grow up.
Yeah,
you could lose everything. Thankfully, just in time, someone did, and now everything's great again. But it was just that my rocket went up too quick.
But it wasn't. Like the stuff you were doing was bad.
No.
It was good stuff.
There was just a lack of that. It could have come across like a lack of integrity.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
But if you were young, if I saw you
next week and you were suddenly in flares with an afro and say, I'm now called Tom Lucy.
Yeah.
Like, no one could say you were a kiddie fiddler or you plagiarised someone's material or you were a drug addict, but people would, when you spoke your material on stage, people would think, but is that really you?
Yeah.
We're a very shallow creature. It's weird in such a left-wing liberal profession where we accept everything. Me simply changing my hair drew the most criticism I've ever had from the most amount of people in my entire life, and with real consequences as well.
Really?
Yeah, I started to lose work.
So what happened when, was it, it must have been like three or four years ago when you then changed the suits and the...
Well, when I met Lindsay, thank God, I met Lindsay, and she was like, what are you doing? You're a grown-up.
Did you meet her in the middle of all that?
She was in the front row of my crowd.
Yeah, I've heard that.
And she was like, what are you doing? You dress like a twat. Everyone thinks you look like a twat. She told me. She's like, everyone's saying you look like a twat. She's like, look here on the internet, look here. And I was like, oh, shit, do I? She's like, well, it's not that you look like a twat. It's just that you look so different to how you did 2 years ago. It looks like you're on drugs or you've had a nervous breakdown.
Yeah.
Whereas, in fact, I was like, I'm on telly. I'm going to wear outrageous clothes.
Is it that sort of like... Because that was around the time of Russell Brand doing all that stuff, and was that the same sort of thing?
But he always was outrageous. He was the heroin taking MTV presenter.
It's only because you changed.
I one time was like, my mum, my dad, my cancer state, and the next minute I got a Camden haircut. People like, come,
okay, see you later. It's only because he always had it.
It wasn't a big thing. This is minor.
But
thankfully Lindsay came along. She's like, what are you doing? She went, maybe it's time for a change the scene, change your management. There was nothing wrong with my management, but I just wanted to shake things up a bit.
Yeah.
I've been at Avalon at that point, however many years, I don't know, 7-8 years, and I thought, I've never gone through my life without changing my job or shaking things up every few years, so I don't want to fall into that habit now. So I was like, right, change my management, change the channels I'm working for, and finally finish puberty. It's been a long time fucking coming. And I literally cleared my wardrobe.
Yeah.
All my silly clothes. Still in real life, I still dress like a bellend because it's my genuine taste. I put a suit on, combed my hair, which took a lot of willpower.
Yeah.
Shave most days, and I haven't looked back since. And I guess it's a marrying of the boy I was when I started stand up. Then yeah. There was the adolescence, and now I'm in my adult phase. Now I'm just sort of enjoying this new stage at the moment, which is people are not. I've done it to myself, really. People take me a lot younger than my age, but once I can catch my chronological age up with how people perceive me, I'm hoping there's like a more Jonathan Rossi, Graham Norton-y type, sitting in the back of the chair, interviewing people, statesman-y type career down the line.
That would be great, wouldn't it?
So at the moment, I'm sort of stuck in primary school where I've been held back. It's good that people take you younger for your age, but at the same time, I'm not that young, and I'm keen to host my own shows and work on BBC One and ITV. I do want to. So that's why I did my whole last show was about age, because I thought it's such a good subject to talk about how people never feel the right age they are. And I realised that a 21-year-old has this problem as much as a 41-year-old. Like, someone who's 20 feels a lot older. Don't treat me like I'm barely a teenager. I'm 30 in my head. I've got my own flat. I know my political views. I could be married if I want, but I don't want to be. Like a lot, and you got 40-year-olds feel the other way. You want to speak to the 70-year-olds and see their faces when I speak about feeling a bit older, then the insult that goes across their face.
Yeah.
I realised it was a really funny subject to jump off from.
It's weird, because when I sort of first met my manager, who's the same as you, I was like...
Where are you at the moment, Avalon?
Off the curb.
You're at curb now,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So
what talking about?
So I was like 17 when I met them for the first time, and I remember now, even though I'm only 21, I remember sort of saying things to them and sort of thinking that I knew a lot more than I did.
Yeah.
And even now, looking back, I think I must have been so sort of weird to be 17 and acting like you knew what you were doing.
But my experience of, because my life really started, my adult life, like if you go back and think... Jump back in your head in the past and look out from your eyes, there's like a big fuzzy bit where you're a kid and playing with your action men and going, oh, I'm going to wee in the garden. And then all of a sudden, it's the same brain you have now. I know you might have been a bit more immature when you're 17, but if you jumped into your 17-year-old body, you roughly walk the same. You've got the adult views. You know what you want from dating. You know what you want politically. It's about 16, you suddenly go, whoop, I'm grown.
Yeah.
And my experience has been this. From about 21 to about 31, you're like, oh my God, can't believe I thought I was grown up when I was 16. But then when you get past 31, you slowly realise that it's completely the other way around. The older you get, the less, you know, the less confident you are. And I've got a sneaking feeling that when you get to about 80, age 16 to 20 is probably the most grown up you ever felt in your entire life.
Yeah.
The most confident and grown up you ever felt in your entire life was 16, 17, 18. And the older you get, the more you think, well, you know, I've still got lots to learn. Oh, God, I didn't know anything back then. Whereas when you were 17, you're like, I know it all. Yeah. Fully adult, no one could teach me anything.
Well, but even though you don't, but you just think you do.
Yes, the most grown up you'll ever feel is about 17 years old.
Yeah.
And it's downhill from then to the point where when people in the 60s and 70s are like, I've given up. Life's an adventure. I know nothing. We're all children.
And there's loads of, like, in music and comedy, and there's loads of great things that happen purely because someone's young and headstrong and they don't listen to people, and then they end up creating something that no one's done before.
Indeed.
Purely because they're not listening to anyone because they're 21, 22.
True, but it very rarely in stand-up. And the reason for that is, and we should be glad, really, it's a pain for someone like you, because the number of stand-ups that do anything worth looking at, age between 7 and 21, is tiny. It happens.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, Jack Whitehall, Ross Noble exist. But even someone like Russell Howard, it seems to be 27, 28 is the magic age.
And
the reason is, it's the opposite rule to what you've just said.
Mm.
That's why I think you could start at 50 and be an absolutely amazing stand-up.
Mm.
I think it's more a period. I think you get about 20 years of being absolutely fucking mint as a stand-up. You get a 20-year window. And it doesn't, it's not like being a footballer or a poet or a scientist where you're going to do your good shit when you're younger.
Yeah, it's all when you're older.
You don't need to be older. You've just got a 20-year window. But if that 20-year window starts much before 25, you're probably going to have a bit of a wait. Just purely because most stand-up is experiential.
Yeah.
So unless you're a genius improviser, like Ross Noble, or a genius observer, like Russell Howard and McIntyre, and even they had to wait, you're coming off, you're not coming off of a deep enough bedrock.
Yeah.
And the audience are going to see straight through it. Doesn't matter how funny your adolescent years are, you're getting a fuck off. You must see it all the time in the eyes of the audience. You don't look too young, if you know what I mean. I'm not insulting you. Like, you could get away with being 25, 26.
Yeah.
So people do trust you more. But if you look 21 and you talk about 21-year-old things,
yeah,
90% of your audience, even if they're 25,
yeah,
are going to give you you must see it all the time,
yeah,
in the eyes, the fuck off. Because I used to get it so much when I was new, because I look a bit younger than my age, I ended up telling people, oh, no, I've done this and this, I've done my degree. I used to have to say it at the top to get people to trust me.
I do remember definitely, like, when I was sort of 18, 19, doing clubs, like, clubs full of, like, 50-year-old men.
Yeah.
And walking on stage and just... even I would think, like, what have I got to say to these people?
Yeah.
Like, 18-year-old kid, what am I going to say to these, like, 350-year-old men?
Yeah.
That they're going to have any interest in?
And it turned out it was, thank you very much, good night.
Yeah, yeah, but it's just... You know,
it's the only way you could smash that was if you went on with a deadpan face and was like, here are some one-liners, and they were fucking mint.
Yeah.
Because they transcend experience.
Yeah. I mean,
or politics.
Yeah. Is stand-up and touring something you want to be doing sort of forever?
I want full Ken Dodd it all the way to the finish line. Yeah. like if you'd have told me that I would be more productive and faster now, it goes against everything we know about science of cognition and brain and human development.
Yeah.
Yet there is no doubt about it. I don't know if it's the food we were talking about earlier, the food I'm eating, like, or the bulletproof coffees, or because I'm looking after myself, or just because I'm just hitting that middle. I'm in that middle peak of that 20-year thing.
Mm.
But the speed at which I can go from, right, let's do a joke about televisions, and you would send me in there for 2 minutes. I'd be able to come back from routine now faster than 2 years ago by about 20%, which doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
I should be like, where's my Werther's? So I'm doing these things now called canings, where I'm improvising stand-up.
Yeah.
Improvising material, not improvising stuff. Well, I can't use that tomorrow because there won't be someone with a funny hat in the front row. I can go, right, I want to do a routine about Lindsay. I want to do a routine about men and women driving. I'll just go to the 99 Club tonight, see what comes out of my mouth.
Yeah.
Then I'll come back and have a routine. That's new. That's just started the last couple of years. So as long as I've got that skill, why wouldn't I continue? So if I'm coming into sort of a peak now so far as how I can write, then I don't see why I would want to give it up in the next 15, 20 years max. But
in the sense of you talk about that, like, 20-year period... Where do you think you are?
Bang in the middle of the 10-year thing. Well, yeah. I am. I'm literally 10 years in.
Yeah.
And I think when you hit a decade in this business... At 5 years... How long have you been doing it? 3 years?
4 years, yeah.
At 5 years, for most of us, is the point where you can step on stage and think, do you know what, I'm just going to fucking mess around with that geezer in the front row and see what happens. You're that level of statesman-like improvisational confidence... allows you to find space in the material as well.
Yeah.
Before that, if you've written a really funny routine about going to Thailand, you're always going to do, I need to get to the bit where I get food poisoning. But as soon as after 5 years, the space opens and the confidence, like if we were having a conversation now, we might go off in different directions. That's at 5 years. In the next 5 years, there's almost like a... Like, you know, in... have you seen a movie called A Beautiful Mind with Russell Crowe, where he opens his eyes and you can see the numbers and stuff? You start to walk into a room. You don't even need to go on stage. You stand at the back and go, right, yep, that's going to happen there. That'll happen. That energy, compares in that movie. And
Yeah.
So that you become like a master, if you like, of the profession about 10 years in.
But I think that's more you than...
But most...
Because I think on stage you can see how quickly your brain works.
If you're good, I mean.
Yeah.
No, I think anyone who's good with that much experience, whether they're Jack D...
Yeah.
Or Jimmy Carr, Frankie Boyle...
Yeah.
All those people that have got a decade of experience can do that, trust me. They can saunter on and they know the score instantly. Yeah. I'm sure 1 in 1,000 gigs, they still get surprised.
Yeah.
But they know. They know how it's going to go. They probably know it's sound check. You just learn it. You learn everything. You can't help it.
What I think is quite weird, which I've noticed only in the last few months, is when, because I kind of feel like I'm at a stage now where I'm sort of starting to sort of calm down and be more relaxed on stage a little bit.
Because you're approaching 5 years. Yeah. There's something magic about that 5 year mark.
But it's that thing of being on stage, like the Comedy Store, for example, and sort of smashing it, but not really giving a shit in your head.
While you're smashing it. Afterwards, you still buzz off it afterwards?
No, I do, but I had an experience the other week where I was doing a weekend at the Comedy Store, and the late show was going so well, but I didn't really, in my head, I was just going, sort of, But that was the first time I've ever felt, normally, if the gig's going really well, I'm like, oh, this is amazing.
Well, you can't, I still get, particularly if I'm doing a 2 hour show, the out of body thing, where you're suddenly looking down at yourself doing stand up, you're like, oh shit, I'm concentrating. You're not in the moment.
Yeah.
And that can happen in anything in life.
Yeah.
But yeah, if I could give a tip to any stand up, is definitely try to feel. The more you feel what you're speaking, the more you put your genuine emotions in, the better the gig will be, the better the audience will be.
Yeah.
The better your career will go. Even it, this career is like up and down. You'll have moments where you're the next big thing and then you're like, oh, yeah, I've made a mistake with my life. And that's how it goes the whole time. Yeah. You incredibly have a great run at it. Like if you look at what Rob and Ramesh are doing, for example, they're doing a steady climb, in my opinion, all the way to the fucking top.
Yeah.
And power to them, the two of the loveliest blokes you'll ever meet.
Mm.
But for most of us, it's incredibly steep shit, followed by a flat bit, followed by, oh my God, there's a cliff, go that way.
Yeah.
So the only consistent thing you can do is be on stage, smashing your gigs and like doing them from the heart, particularly if you're doing biographical material.
Yeah.
But it's easier said than done. You are going to have nights where you feel a bit dead on the inside, particularly if you're doing two gigs on the night.
Yeah.
That's probably what it is.
Yeah.
How many, doing it twice in the night is...
Well, that day I was talking about was a Saturday night in London, and I'd done 5 gigs. So that was the 5th one of the night. So I think that was why I was just a bit like, oh, this does...
There you go.
Too much.
That's all it is.
Yeah.
It's what's called I've only studied acting from books in my own time, but the main guy is called Stanislavski, and he's the one like Robert De Niro and Al Pacino about method acting and how you get into feeling it. And there's some people are really good mechanical performers, so you'll still be laughing your ass off and crying. And as an audience member, you would never know that thing was missing because mechanically it was perfect.
Yeah,
and moved in the right way, they delivered the line perfect. But that is totally different from a method full performance where you let the anger go through you if it's about a parking ticket, for example, or you let the despair or the laughter at something your dad said has to come through you for real.
Yeah.
The more you can do that. And the best way, and if you can't do it because you're not an actor and that all sounds a bit scary, the best way to do it, I think, is to not have too much of a set script, to have bullets, to have beats and words you got hit, but to have flow around that so you can change it each night.
Yeah.
That's what I do. So that's why I don't get bored. Last tour was 120 dates. I was still fucking hungry for it, like animal, like on the end.
Changing things and...
I know what's going to happen in the routine.
Yeah.
I know Lindsay's going to say that. I know this is going to happen. I know I'm definitely going to use this line, that line, and that line. But the rest is all up for grabs.
Yeah.
To the point where people who came and saw the tour 2 or 3 times really noticed that it was different. It's funny listening to people because I did the same routines, but they feel like I've done a completely different show. The show is completely different. Exactly.
Yeah.
It wasn't.
Yeah.
It's exactly the same with slightly different words. Because the emotions are real.
Yeah.
They felt things in different places because I've felt things in different places depending on what mood I'm in. So they remember a different show. It's that powerful. The difference between a mechanical and a performance where you feel it.
Yeah.
It's crazy, isn't it?
It's mad. I think it was something I was going to talk to you particularly about, but because you seem like I was chatting to someone the other day about the fact that they think in order to write interesting stuff, you've got to make sure that you're sort of doing a lot and keeping your brain, as in like reading and watching films and travelling and all that, just doing things that are keeping you interested in. And you definitely seem like someone who, whether it's a conscious effort or you just aren't genuinely interested in a lot of things.
Yeah, I think there's definitely something in that. All the science backs that up.
Yeah.
You're going to less likely to get Alzheimer's if you learn a language and do puzzles, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So I always think the best way to try and find if something is true about the human brain, there's two ways. One, look at it cross-culturally, what happens in other countries and other cultures. And B, what happens at the beginning and end of life when things are more extreme.
Yeah.
For example, like I said, children that are given proper intellectual stimulation, their brains are developing a proper way, and older people that are trying to fight off dementia, one of the best ways to do it is give them a fucking puzzle book or get them learning French or get them to go out meeting people. So that those rules will be the same for us lot in the middle.
Yeah.
Therefore, if you're a stand-up and your main tool is your brain, why would you want to let it turn to mush?
Mm.
That's not... The danger then is you slip into snobbery. That doesn't, for you... Well, for me, rather, I watch TOWIE every week. I watch it, but I watch it actively.
Yeah.
I laugh. I'm thinking of ideas. I'm interacting with the program. I'm like, there's a trend. There's a turning over of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I love literature, and I've got quite poncy tastes, and I am learning French at the moment. At the same time, why the fuck not? So I do all that stuff to keep the cogs turning.
Yeah.
But there's not like a continuum with someone who watches EastEnders at the bottom.
Yeah.
And Stuart Lee reading Wittgenstein at the top. As long as your brain is jumping into the material, as I call it.
Yeah.
Because we're busy. So you can't go to Botswana backpacking just to get a routine. But as long as you keep your active brain going when you're watching TOWIE or when you're seeing your mates. Like my notes on my phone fills up each week, even if I don't go out a single time.
Yeah.
This week, loads of funny stuff has happened.
Yeah.
Like a takeaway turned up the other night and something funny happened, so I immediately go and write it down. So as long as you're going actively into experiences, the danger is if you just like become like a Facebook vegetable and drink too much, any sort of chemical or alcohol abuse, you'll see the creativity start to...
Just being aware.
Yeah, but if you can do the more active, difficult ones, do them.
Mm.
If you can... Get yourself to fucking Venice for the weekend with your girlfriend, walk around, look at shit, get drunk, go to a gallery, go to a local square, see what happens.
Mm.
But don't go to write, just go to experience. Do keep, I always try and keep a non-comedy related thing on the go. So at the moment I'm learning French, a little app. Always something.
Yeah.
Always have a book on the go, always. Good audio book. Anything that challenges your thinking... Listen to debate-based podcasts because they tend to get the part of your brain that debates going. And then that same part of the brain will be in the line in Sainsbury's and go, why does it have to be that way? You think that's quite funny. And you'll write it down. So listen to Moral Maze, listen to In Our Time, listen to Question Time, any questions.
Yeah,
get into all that shit.
I think because I feel like it can be an industry where you can get too sucked into it and it becomes your entire... existence.
Well, this is the other thing that probably hasn't done me many favours. I don't do it on purpose.
Yeah.
It's happened accidentally. My mates are my mate Wayne, who I met when I was 6 at infant school. My mate Dan, who I met swimming when I was 8. My mate Lee, who I met infant school when I was 7.
Yeah.
Scott, 16. Martin, 11. They're my core group of 5 mates.
Yeah.
I don't hang out and go drinking with comics, not because I'm like unfriendly and don't think comics are great people. I just love my mates from home.
Yeah,
I've never got round to dumping them. I see my mum, my nan, my aunties, my cousins, and what I've realised over the years, accidentally, what a fucking brilliant move that was. Because you can watch all the comedians that hang together because they start to get the same voice, the same ideas. Oh my god, have you seen the new Joey Mc? Tavish special, it's like some American, you know, they wank off over the same American comedians I've never heard of. Don't watch too much American comedy.
Yeah.
Try not to watch any if you can bear to.
Yeah.
There are some people worth watching, like Chris Rock, but if you watch, you can watch the people that have watched too many Netflix specials.
Yeah.
And they even stand with like their left foot slightly out in front of the mic and then they go and hang out with like you know, Bobby, John, and everyone who went was in the same year at Lancaster Uni and have the same bands.
And then,
of course, you lose it because you go out to Edinburgh and people think you're copying each other. But what it is, you've hung around. I'm not saying don't be friends with other comics.
Yeah.
And go out, but don't make it your life. Make your life your mum, your dad, your family's from home, your kids, your missus. That's your life. And with the occasional, like me and Stephen Grant will go out for coffee or out for lunch, or I might go out for dinner now and again with Brodkin. But I'm not like five nights a week, you know, putting the world to rights in a trendy Camden pub with Johnny McPerrier newcomer and everyone. Because it's dangerous.
Yeah.
Don't burn your own style.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, all the people I hang out with are all schoolmates.
That's the best way to be.
Yeah.
Look at the people that are truly fucking excellent at stand-up. I don't care what. Let's put snobbery aside for a second. Let's look at Peter Kay. Let's look at Michael McIntyre.
They all live quite normal.
Let's look at Russell
life.
Howard. Let's look at Stuart Lee, Daniel Kitson, Frankie Boyle. Have you ever seen them sat in the wanker pub swilling beer with five other people? Going through the orange prize list and doing roll-up cigarettes. It's all the stuff I did at uni, and the stuff that I do, but I do that with my...
Yeah.
Well, not my mates from home, they're all carpenters and plumbers. But
yeah.
If I got a night off, I'll spend it... I'd rather go for dinner with Lindsay or hang out with my daughter or something.
Yeah.
Well, she's two, so she's not very good. She's a bit bored at the moment. But yeah, do you know what I mean? I'm not saying it's to be horrible.
Yeah.
I'm saying it as you're asking if this world can consume you. Yeah, it can on that level.
Yeah.
So if you're living your life on the road and service stations, doing gigs and hanging with comics, sooner or later, you're going to start doing routines with... I'll tell you something else that happened to me at a gig once.
Yeah, and it just becomes about other gigs.
Which is not a problem. Sometimes genuinely funny, transcendent things happen at gigs. So like, yes, I got heckled at a gig once by a Shakespeare tutor, but it led to a general story.
Yeah.
So if you're doing a something happened to me at a gig once routine, make sure it takes you into a universal truth.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it means you are disappearing into the comedy bumhole, as I call it.
Russell Kane there, ladies and gentlemen. I really enjoyed that chat. I thought he was incredibly intelligent and had an awful lot to say. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much to Russell for having me round to his house to record that. Thank you very much to you for listening, of course. Thank you to Will Shahada for the editing, Joel Grove for producing the show, my manager Rick Hughes for all your help. And I've been told to tell you to subscribe, if you haven't already, and give it 5 stars on iTunes. Apparently that helps a lot. And we'll be back next week with another guest. Thank you for listening. See you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men. This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.